Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we begin the week at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Kest Boulevard in Boston, where the city, despite a lawsuit from the ACLU of Massachusetts, is continuing to remove tents. This as the makeshift courtroom in Suffolk County Jail continues to process some people living there who have outstanding warrants, and that's with mixed results around housing and treatment. Now, in a moment, we will hear from Marty Martinez, who is the Chief of Health and Human Services for the City of Boston. But first, we want to turn to WBUR Senior Correspondent Deborah Becker, who has spent the day at Mass and Cast today. Deb, what's the latest? What are you seeing and hearing today?
Well, today, another section of tents is being removed. And this is on Atkinson Street, which is really the most dense part of the tent encampment that has sprung up at the so-called Mass and Cast area. Some people estimate there are about 200 people living in the tents on Atkinson Street. And today, about a dozen of those tents are scheduled to be removed. This has been going on all day. City workers have been going to the tents and offering people shelter and storage bins to remove their belongings, and then collecting up the tents. A short time ago, city DPW garbage trucks got there, and those people whose tents were removed and belongings were put into storage bins, those tents and the remainder of the things there are put into the back of the garbage truck. Some activists here are offering to help people get supplies, sometimes other things to continue to stay out in the cold if they're not accepting the shelter that the city is offering. And I spoke with Cassie Hurd, who's with the Material Aid and Advocacy Program, and she said a lot of people who are leaving this stretch of Atkinson Street where the removals are taking place today are going to other nearby streets. Let's listen.
Some people have moved a few blocks away and are trying to stay in the area in community with each other, close by to services. Many people receive daily medication. So some people are staying in the area. Others we know well have moved to suburbs because of the ban on both tents and encampments, are feeling like there's nowhere they'll be able to go within the city limits where they won't then be moved along.
And also, Tiziana, I spoke with a man who was also helping people here on Atkinson Street today. His name is Ron Geddes. He was cleared out of his tent on Southampton Street about 2 weeks ago, but he pitched a tent nearby because he said he goes to the methadone clinic every day. So he moved nearby so he can continue to do that. Let's listen to what he said.
I'm a man that tries to, you know, work hard and do what I'm supposed to do, and I don't want to be here no more than anybody else wants me here. I just don't want to live where they're asking me to. I don't have the money they're asking me for to rent a house or apartment where I grew up all my life. I just can't afford it.
Now, Geddes said that the placement that he was offered was in a nearby homeless shelter, but because of his mental health issues, he doesn't want to go there, so he's staying on the streets.
So, Deb, I also know, we know the ACLU of Massachusetts announced its lawsuit against the city last Friday. What does the lawsuit maintain or assert, and why hasn't the city stopped clearing tents while there's this lawsuit going?
Well, the lawsuit claims that the city and acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey has been violating people's rights with the city's executive order to remove these tents. The suit claims that people are being displaced without being placed in appropriate housing or treatment as promised. It also says the city cannot threaten criminal sanctions against those who refuse to move from the tents without offering them appropriate housing arrangements. And Acting Mayor Janey said on Friday that the executive order still stands, that people are offered housing, they are offered storage, they are offered the ability to continue to connect with their medical care providers, and these removals are being done as part of a public health approach to what's happening in that neighborhood.
Okay, and Deb, the court at Suffolk County Jail, which is continuing this week, you followed some pretty mixed outcomes in terms of housing and treatment when it started. I take it from reporting in the Globe that DA Rachel Rollins is softening a bit on her support for it. What is the latest as of today?
So the court was in session for 3 days last week, and then today it was in session. There was one person who appeared in the court so far today, so that means a total of 10 people have appeared in this session in the week that it's been operating, and two of those 10 people have gone to treatment. Many of them, as you said, they were all brought in on outstanding criminal warrants, and many of the 10 were then transferred to the jurisdictions or other courts, if you will, where those outstanding warrants were issued to have those charges taken care of. So not many people really are going to treatment as a result of their appearance in this court.
All right, WBUR Deborah Becker, please stand by. I will come back to you, but we're going to turn to another voice here, Marty Martinez, who is Chief of Health and Human Services for the City of Boston, serving in both the Walsh and now Janney administrations. Public health and recovery services, among other departments, fall under his leadership. Chief Martinez, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So glad to have you, Chief Martinez. I know you were listening there. We heard, for example, Deb played that sound from Cassie Hurd from the Material Aid and Advocacy Program saying people are leaving the city. They feel like there's nowhere to go within the city limits. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the city, our goal is clear. I mean, we want to get people into a better place. We want to get people into the right level of treatment, support. And most importantly, we want to get people off the street, out of a tent, especially as the weather turns and what has been an unsafe environment for them, an unsafe environment for folks around them. And so that really is our goal. I mean, we have over the past basically seven days or so gotten over 60 individuals have responded by going into a bed, whether it's a detox bed, whether it's a shelter bed, whether it has been a single room occupancy bed, and or some people have to go somewhere else, you know, help me get back to my family in another city or town. So we've been able to get over 60 folks there, and that's what we're really trying to do is get people the care they need.
What percentage is that, Chief Martinez, of the people who have been moved, that 60 number?
Out of the what percentage of the 60 is that of the whole number?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Yeah. So the 60 out of what?
Yeah, so out of the 60, so when we did our point-in-time count, which we're doing basically now every weekend to sort of understand who's there and how we can help folks, there were roughly about 3 weeks ago about 340 folks on the street in this area. And so that 60 number, about 64 actually, is out of that number. But we also know other folks, you know, as this has started, other folks are connecting to their care in other places. So they don't wait for us to come and decide it's time to move on. They move on their own. Some end up at different shelters. Some folks end up connected to care in different programs. For us, we really can't let folks just stay in the cold in a tent on the street. And so we've got to make sure we get folks better alternatives, and that's what we're trying to do every single day.
I was struck by Ron Geddes, who Deb Becker also played sound from, who was in one tent. That tent was removed. He wants to be able to stay in engagement with the methadone treatment that he's receiving. Mm-hmm. So now he's moved around the corner to another tent. I mean, we have to assume that for some portion of the people, that's what the story is here, especially when low threshold housing, which is while you're actively using, we have a shortage in that. So what is the solution there, and what is the promise for the Ron Geddeses who want to stay in treatment and have consistently said, I can't afford housing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing is that with this, you know, with the protocol that's laid out and through the Mayor Janney's executive order, the goal is really this, is to lead with services first. And so our goal is not just to remove tents and get them out of the way and get them so that they're not visible. That's never been the goal, and that's never been what it's about. What we do and try to continue to do is make sure we can find the right resource to match the need that someone has. And we know for many folks that need is more complicated than just an individual bed, but it's about a wraparound of supports and services. So that's the legwork we're doing every day. I mean, as I know your listeners know, we're on the street, the public health folks, we're on the street 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, engaging folks that are living in tents to support them and connect them to care. And so that's what we're going to keep doing. If someone moves their tent and doesn't want to be there but ends up going somewhere else four blocks away, we're going to engage them again, because we really don't want to leave people struggling on a tent on the street. We think there are better options, and we're going to keep not only working to connect and engage, but make sure that there those better options exist, which we're working on every single day.
And you know there is this portion. Ron Geddes told Deborah Becker that he doesn't want to go into shelter. You know there is a portion of people who don't, whether it's their vulnerability or they need to stay with a partner or they're worried it will disrupt their treatment plans or they worry that they won't get medical care if they need it. How do you address that?
Yeah. So that's why we have to make sure that there are more and specific kinds of resources and beds available for folks. So, for example, this week we have some low threshold beds, transitional beds coming online, not in the neighborhood, in partnership with the state and a provider. We have a number of beds
coming
available this week. At the end of this project, there will be about 40 additional beds that come available between this week and next week in this low threshold space. We're going to put more beds online in partnership with the state, but there's no question that there's a need for more transitional spaces for people to stabilize. I think what's important for the city is we know people can't get stable in a tent on the street when they're just trying to survive. And so for us, we want to get them into those other pathways. We heard so much talk about how for some folks, the shelter isn't the right space for them, and that is absolutely the case. But it is the right space for some, and we've seen that with, you know, several dozen folks going into Pine Street, going into 112, going into Woods Mullen, you know, to start, you know, getting a bed, getting support, and getting stabilized to go to that next place. So we know it's not going to work for everyone, the shelters, but we also know that we got to put more beds online, and that's something we're doing every day with the state. As you know, the mayor's executive order called for a central coordinating structure. And we've been meeting, we meet Tuesdays and Thursdays mornings where we're looking at the beds, looking at the resources, and figuring out what else we need to do to bring more online. But it's a struggle that we're going to continue to take on until everyone has what they need.
Is there a way to do what you want to do, to achieve the end game that you've laid out, where there is no coercion?
Yeah, I will say, to be really clear, throughout what we've done through the executive order, not a single person has been arrested. Not a single person has been put in, you know, the community response session that you talked about related to our encampment protocol. You know, on the public health side, our team, we know the folks that are living in these tents. We build relationships with them. We get them care. We're giving them life-saving support, whether it's through a provider that we're contracting or through our own outreach workers that are going there day to day. So for us, it's about helping people get on a better path, whatever that might look like for them. I think what the mayor has been clear about, Mayor Janey, is that living in a tent on a street has become and became a public safety, public health crisis that she would not allow to continue, and wanted us to do everything we could to get people in better spaces and better places. And that's what we've been doing, and we're going to have to continue to do that.
So I'm sure you've seen the op-ed in The Globe by Drs. Benjamin Linus and Joshua Barocas. They are modeling likely outcomes. This is statistical modeling. And they argue real public health harm and increased costs will likely result from the executive order and what the city's doing. I'm going to give you a quote from it. Quote, the cleanup will lead to an immediate 30% increase in the overdose rate among those who had been living in the encampment. The overdose rate will remain elevated for approximately 9 months after the sweep, end quote. What's your response to that and to their modeling?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the specifics of their modeling. I understand the you know, the challenge that's presented when we go into these areas like encampments like this, which exist all over the country and in cities, and don't provide the support that we need to provide. And the reality is on the public health side, we're committed to making sure people get the care they need and they stay connected to that care. Having said that, there's no one who's doing work on the ground consistently in this area who believes and can rightfully say that letting people stay in tents on the street, disconnected from the supports they need, which has not only had people prey on them, but has also created so many other challenges in this area, is the better alternative. So we have to work using a public health model first, getting people care and support that they need, connected to their medical provider, connected to folks who can get them the right level of support and care in a bed. We have to do that while at the same time making sure that we don't lose people from the connections they have and the resources they have. So I can't speak to their specific modeling, but what I can tell you is there's no question everyone doing this work wants to get people on a better pathway, and that's the work we're going to continue to do.
So I am struck by this idea. We'll have Brendan Little, who is a former employee of the city of Boston, later in the show,
yeah,
who argues about the importance of the social connections and social ties that people form when they are engaged in their own problem solving, and that
right,
moving people out of the area, if they have built social ties there, if they have built community, even if it's not a community seen or recognized by people from outside, that that is a real loss. And we know social connections are one of the most, the research shows, it's one of the most important strategies for people to solve their own problems. So when people are dispersed, what happens to those social connections, and what can the city do to help maintain that important problem-solving asset?
That's a great point, and obviously it's great that you'll have Brendan on, who obviously has done so much great work for us in the city and in other places as well as having a powerful personal story. I think the most important point to remember, it's about making sure that you honor the sense that that community is built, that the needs that people have, that many folks on the street help each other meet those needs, right? Keeping each other alive, keeping each other connected, and protecting one another. If your goal is to just get rid of tents so that people don't see it anymore, and so that when the news goes down there, they don't have a sensational picture to look at, if that's your goal, then yeah, of course, absolutely, you're missing what really needs to happen for folks that are in these situations. But when your goal is to connect people to care and resources and support, and to ensure that you're wrapping yourself around someone who has to be somewhere else and figuring out the right resource to connect them to, I couldn't agree more that we have to make sure we're replicating that care in other places and that community in other places, and that the barriers that exist in those systems that prevent people from being able to get that care and build that support are broken down. So I can't agree more. The city's working through that. It's why we have providers at the table. It's why we're working to make sure that we can get not only a bed, but wrap ourselves around individuals in these beds and to stabilize them and get them on a better path. So that sense of community is key. It's not about a sense of community that, you know, everyone's going to understand, but we have to make sure we're trying to replicate that as much as possible. But we do believe and continue to hold true that what's happening on the street, in this neighborhood, and in these tents had become a challenge that we no longer could allow to just sit. And it become a public safety challenge, especially for those living in the tents. And that's why we're doing our very best to balance this out and get people into a better place.
We are talking with Marty Martinez, Chief of Health and Human Services for the City of Boston. Chief Martinez, Mayor-elect Michelle Wu is sworn in a week from tomorrow. Sense of her thinking on the issue? Have you been in touch with her people?
Yeah, no, we, as you know, we're going through this transition, and we did have the opportunity to already brief Mayor-elect Wu last week on all things math and CAS and what we're working on and what we're tackling. And she had a lot of great questions, and I know that she's going to tackle this head on. It's been clear this is going to be a number one priority for her. And so we're eager to continue the work, as I know she wants to make sure we focus on it. So we're eager to keep doing that.
So you've served in the Walsh administration, now the Janey administration. There's a new mayor coming in, potentially your third administration. What is next for you? And do you plan to continue to work with the Wu team?
Yeah, I'm eager to make sure that this transition into a new mayor is done, that keeps everything moving, right? Let's be clear, folks battling substance use disorder in our community, they don't care who the mayor is. They want to make sure that their needs are met, and I care deeply about that as well. So I'm going to do everything to help transition Mayor-elect Wu and the team into this role, and continue to do the work until I leave this seat that I know Bostonians need us to do to give people a better path. So that's what I'm going to continue to do and keep working that in that direction.
All right. Marty Martinez is the chief of health. Well, no, I'm going to ask you, if she asks you to serve, will you serve in a Wu administration?
Yeah, I'm committed to doing whatever I can do to help Mayor-elect Wu and make sure the transition's a healthy and strong one. So looking forward to continuing that conversation with her.
All right. Marty Martinez, Chief of Health and Human Services for the City of Boston. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
Let's turn back to WBUR senior correspondent Deb Becker, who's still with us from the area around Mass Ave and Melnia Cass Boulevard. But Deb, what stood out to you from that conversation just now with Chief Martinez?
Well, I wonder if he's going to stay. That's one. But I think in terms of the Mass and Cass issue, I think the low threshold housing that he mentioned is key. And I think that really is the main issue. The folks who are being removed from the neighborhood today on Atkinson Street, I'm told, are only being offered placement at area homeless shelters. So there is a significant shortage of so-called low-threshold housing where people, for a variety of reasons, can't go to these shelters. And the fact that 40 beds are expected to come online as part of the state partnership as soon as this week, I think is important for this situation to be alleviated in some way. So that was, I think, a very positive note, but 40 is a small number when you're talking, you know, as he said, more than 340 people living in tents in that area. So there is a dire need for that, and you know, it remains to be seen whether there will be enough supply to meet that need.
And Deb, as we watch to see whether he stays, right, as we have a new mayor sworn in next Tuesday, what else are you going to be watching for during this change in administration?
Well, you know, I went to that briefing that Michelle Wu, Marilette Wu, had with reporters after she met with folks about all things Mass and Cass last week. And I think it was interesting that, you know, she said that she said much of what Chief Martinez said, that she wants people to get off the streets, especially before the winter. And she does think that the city could do better in providing services to people. But she believes that helping people and connecting them with services is a priority. The interesting thing that she said during that briefing was that she was concerned about the court session that's operating in the Suffolk County House of Correction, and mainly that Boston police had arrested some people to bring to that court session who were waiting in line to get the addiction medication methadone. Wu called that unacceptable. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how this all continues to play out and how the city and state might commit to more plans to provide transitional non-congregate housing for the people here.
And again, as you pointed out earlier, Deb, only 2 of 10 people who have been processed through that court have gone into treatment at this point. That's WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker. Deb, we really appreciate your sustained attention with us on this. Thank you for your coverage.
Thanks for having me.
And we continue our coverage of the tent removal happening around the area of Mass Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard now. Brendan Little is the former policy director for the Mayor's Office of Recovery Services under Mayor Marty Welsh. And as a young person, he struggled with addiction and was unhoused. Now he argues in an op-ed in the Boston Globe that a closer look at those temporary shelters that the city's clearing out reveals a community, a network of social capital and support that is essential for people's long-term stability, their recovery. And he worries that clearing the area out clears people's strategies for survival along with tents and debris. Brendan Little is now a council member on the state's Opioid Recovery and Remediation Fund Advisory Council. Joins us now. Brendan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Brendan, what are people losing besides their belongings and their temporary shelter when the city clears away a tent?
I think it's really important to think about why people are on the street and who they're interacting with on a day-to-day basis. Oftentimes people who are in mass casts, they've burnt many bridges in their life, or they've lost loved ones. And the people that are their strongest connection are their fellow peers on the street, and also harm reduction workers, recovery outreach workers, both at the city and nonprofits in the area. And those people are sometimes the lifeline for them, often the lifeline for them to maintain their wellness. So I think that, you know, it's really important that when, you know, enacting any policies that have to do with moving people along, that you maintain those social connections. And it's really hard to do if it's not thought through and if it's not coordinated in a way that offers people dignity and wellness.
So why? Explain it to us, and maybe you can give us an example, Brian. Why is it hard to do? Can people just not get in touch with each other? They can't reach each other anymore? Are they moved away? So illustrate that for us. Why is that so hard to preserve?
It's so hard to preserve because, it's tricky to explain. I think there's so much down there. I think when people drive by or they walk by or they see pictures on social media or in the media of mass and cast, they don't want to look at it because it's too scary, you know? And I get it. It is scary. But as a person who was formerly unhoused, as a person in recovery, what I do get is that when all those other social connections are gone, the people that are on the street, you know, they're your lifeline, and they're the ones that are going, you know, they have your back. They are reversing each other's overdoses. They're looking out for each other with food and clothing. Oftentimes they work jobs, various degrees, either under the table or officially. They're in relationships. So when you lose that setting, that social setting, you break communities apart. So I think what's really important is that you offer people non-congregate low threshold shelter, like it has been talked about. And this is not a theory, this is not something that is new to Boston. When the COVID first hit, this was something that was enacted right away. And you had all these frontline staff who've been dealing with one pandemic, all the epidemic, now they're facing a whole other epidemic on top of that. So, I think it's really important for me to lift up the frontline workers that are doing this work each day, as well as the people who have community and find community in that neighborhood each day.
So, Brendan, I want to acknowledge, I think a minute ago I meant to say Brendan, and I think I might have said Brian. And if I did, I apologize. I didn't mean,
that's okay.
I didn't mean disrespect
enough.
There.
Close
no,
enough.
No, it's important, especially because now, Brendan, I'm going to turn to your story. You come at this from a personal place. And I want to ask you, when did you become homeless and for how long were you unhoused?
So I first started running away from home when I was 13 years old and 14 years old. I first started sleeping on the street when I was 14 years old. And back then it was, mass cast wasn't really the area where people congregated so much. It was Copley Square, it was Newberry Street, the Fenway area in Boston. And to me, what I found there was a group of people who were into punk rock music like I was, people who numbed their pain with drugs and alcohol. But also people that were really caring, people that were really kind, people who were smart, diverse communities, people from all parts of the city. And then from there, I started getting involved with law enforcement, getting arrested for petty stuff, drinking in public, truancy. That put me on the radar for DCF. Then it was called DSS and then DYS. So those basically the criminal justice system for youth. And the Department of Children and Families. And that kind of led me on a year of being in and out of various institutions. And then from there, got back home for a little while. Then from 16 to 18 years old, I was unhoused again, staying on couches or sometimes staying on the street. And for me, it was really about, even when I got housed eventually as a young adult, I still stayed very close to the people on the street because they were my community, and I would still go out there and hang out and I would miss them. And I know that sounds strange to some people, but it's very common. I met with a young person a few years ago who had housing in Cambridge and he wasn't sleeping in it. He was sleeping on the street because it felt so foreign to him and he didn't have his community. So I just think it's really important to highlight the community, not only of the people on the street, but of the frontline harm reduction and recovery workers who are out there each day that, don't take breaks, that are out there reversing overdoses, giving people food, warm clothes, and taking care of the people who many people overlook or have forgotten about.
So I want to ask you, you were policy director for the Office of Recovery Services in the Walsh administration. You left in January 2021.
Yes.
Is there something that the Walsh administration was doing that's not happening now? Was there a better job being done then?
I don't know. I think it's difficult to compare. I'm not here to, criticize anybody. I don't know what they're going through. I think the biggest thing that I want to lift up is that, when I was there in January, there weren't, 150 or 200 tents, you know, on the streets. I know that that's really challenging for people, for the harm reduction people, for the people doing the work. It's just, you know, it's a different challenge. It's a different beast. So like, it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges. But the thing I can say is that, you know, we invested heavily with Mayor Walsh, Jen Tracy, Devin Larkin, the team there, Marty Martinez, invested very heavily in an engagement center, which will be open in the next month or so, a brick and mortar engagement center, a street outreach team for the first time, tripling the staff of the PATHS program, which, you know, places people in treatment, expanding harm reduction across the city. So, you know, that's something that I know I've done. But the way I think about it is, you know, I was a policy director, which is a fancy title, but it didn't matter what I was doing if the frontline people on the street, you know, the Sarah Mackins and the Teresas and all the people that I worked with who are the harm reductionists, the tried and true people on the street, if they were telling me, you know, that stuff wasn't working, those were the people I listened to,
Brendan,
because their ear were to the street.
So I'm sure you're aware that the ACLU of Massachusetts is now suing the city over these moves to move people out of tents and temporary shelters. I know during the Walsh administration, Operation Clean Sweep was the summer of 2019, just before the pandemic. Deep criticism of the actions of the Boston Police Department there, where over a two-day period, they arrested dozens of people and cleared out possessions, et cetera. What role should law enforcement have? And did the Walsh administration do the wrong thing with Clean Sweep? Is there any way that law enforcement should be involved in this picture?
I think that law enforcement should be involved to some extent. I think Clean Sweep was deeply traumatic for the people who are on the street, but also for the frontline workers, because it was just, from what I understand, it was a really brash, quick decision based on an altercation with a corrections officer and somebody on the street. So it was very quick. Staff were detained, you know, frontline staff were detained for hours without being told what was going on. So I think that there's a role, and I think that the police street outreach team did some very good work when they were first online. You know, these were officers who directly worked with people, drove them to treatment. You know, some of them were even giving haircuts, you know, really kind of, again, emphasizing this social bond, social connection. I'm not sure if that's happening now, but I think that, you know, there's a role for law enforcement, but I think you can't lead with law enforcement. You know, I've seen harm reduction workers, street outreach workers, you know, keep peace and maintain public safety better than I've seen police who can sometimes agitate situations. I'm not saying that's always the case, but I have seen that happen.
So last question for you, Brendan. Most people listening to this are far, both in terms of distance and lived experience, from what we're talking about here. You're not. What is the most important thing you want people to take away from this conversation?
That there's so many people out there who are doing the work every single day, you know, and they've been doing it for years and years and years since before there was a mass cast moniker that everybody knew, that there are tried and true people out there who are doing the work, taking care of people, and that the area is so stigmatized. But I just want you to know that the people who are there are people. They're so diverse, and they have incredible backgrounds, and they're smart, and they're caring, and the same for the frontline staff. And also, we need to invest both on the front end, which is, you know, low threshold services and harm reduction services to help people who are in active use build trust. And then on the back end, once people are in recovery, we need to give them the economic supports so that they can maintain recovery. Because if there's no reason to get in recovery to have a purpose-driven life, you won't do it. And I think that the front end and the back end are really where we need to invest as a city and a state.
All right. Brendan Little is a member on the state's Opioid Recovery and Remediation Fund Advisory Council, former policy director for the Office of Recovery Services under Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. He has an op-ed in the Boston Globe today. We'll have a link to that piece at our website at radioboston.org. Brendan, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. Imagine you are on your way to work or the grocery store and you come across a bad car accident. There's yellow police tape surrounding the area. Police and fire are recording the scene. They're documenting evidence, whether it's broken glass or skid marks. They don't know what caused the crash, but they're collecting evidence to find out. Every car crash is different. But in the end, there are similarities that maybe could be used to prevent or stop a future accident. For one neurologist, this is how he and his colleagues approach studying brain diseases like Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's. They see each disease and its effect on the brain as a crime scene, offering clues that could eventually lead to cures. Dr. Howard Weiner is the Robert L. Kroc Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School, director and founder of the Brigham MS Center, and co-director of the Ann Romney Center for Neurologic Diseases at Brigham and Women's Hospital. In his new book, The Brain Under Siege, Solving the Mystery of Brain Disease and How Scientists Are Following the Clues to a Cure, Dr. Weiner explores the so-called crime scenes of five brain diseases: multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, and glioblastoma. Dr. Weiner joins us now to talk about the book, what we know and what we don't know about these so-called crime scenes. Dr. Weiner, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So there's so much, Dr. Weiner, and there's a lot I want to get to, but I want to make this manageable for people to engage with us at the start. So you've said one in six people suffer from a brain disease, which is a staggering number. Let's pick one from your book to start, Alzheimer's. How close are we to a cure?
Well, it depends on how you define cure. People define cure in different ways. A cure means that we don't have Alzheimer's anymore. So that's not going to happen so quickly. But how close are we to a treatment? How close are we to have a treatment that might help Alzheimer's? Interestingly, until recently, there have been no FDA-approved treatments that affect Alzheimer's. One was just approved by the FDA, something called aducanumab by Biogen. It came with little controversy, but it has helped people. I think that you mentioned the crime scene. One of the exciting things about Alzheimer's is we know what's at the crime scene and how to address it. And now we have a way to address it, and that's going to lead us to a cure. What will a cure one day look like? I think a cure is going to be the way we cured polio and other infectious diseases, that people who are in their 40s or 50s who have no symptoms will be given a treatment that prevent Alzheimer's. But before then, we have to have something to treat the people who have it now.
So Dr. Weiner, at first, I want to acknowledge you talk in the book about the fact that by 2050, there could be as many as 36 million people in the United States suffering from Alzheimer's. The words that are coming out of your mouth right now are incredibly important to many people who have loved ones who are experiencing that particular brain disease. I want to break this down for their understanding, and then I'm going to widen the aperture to you're saying the way we got to think about cure is there's three different ways. There's prevention. It never happens. There's stop it from getting worse. And then there's, can you undo the damage that's been done? Is that right in how we need to think about treatment and cures of these devastating brain diseases you're talking about in your book?
That's exactly right. Number one is to be able to stop the disease in somebody who has the illness. And number two is to repair a damaged brain. That's harder. We're working on that, but that's harder. And then ultimately is do something to prevent it from happening.
Okay, so now let's go to this crime scene, because what you basically said with Alzheimer's was, at that crime scene, we are at the point where we're saying, aha, we know what happened here. But that's not the case with all five of the diseases that you focus on in the book. Again, you know, Parkinson's, for example, ALS. In which of these brain diseases do we look at the crime scene and we still can't really even tell what happened yet?
Well, I think we can tell. What we can't do is figure out how to affect the crime scene. But if you look at the crime scene, and in my book, The Brain Under the Siege, there's a picture of the crime scene for each disease.
Yep.
So in Alzheimer's, the crime scene is a sticky substance called amyloid, is another substance called tau, that's our proteins, and inflammation of microglia. Those are the three parts of the crime scene. You know, you talk It's the gun and the broken window and a door that's unlocked. Those are the three things, if you will. But we know what those three are, and we're now trying to come up with drugs that affect each of them. Now, one thing that I'll tell you that's very interesting is that one part of the crime scene can lead to the next. So the first thing that comes in Alzheimer's is amyloid, which gets put into the brain. That then triggers tau, and that then triggers inflammation. So, and it's the tau that causes the cognitive problem in people. So another image that I put into the book, which is important, is the idea of an avalanche. So when an avalanche starts, there's a little bit of snow, and it starts going, and then it picks up more and more, and then it gets bigger and bigger. And that's what happens, for example, in Alzheimer's and the other diseases. There's something that starts it, then it gets bigger, and then it spreads. That's why the longer someone has the disease, the harder it is to stop it. The bigger the avalanche, the harder it is to stop it.
So a couple of things, and then I know I'm paging through my book because I want to get to that avalanche picture again. I remember it from the book. I know people want to know what to do, right? They are experiencing these diseases themselves. They have loved ones who are. So I want to get to that. As you walk through the book, there were two other things that struck us as super important. One was the fact that there's so much work on drugs that are sometimes cure, you know, that prevention one. Sometimes it's the stop it in its tracks. Sometimes it's the can we reverse the damage. And often what happens is we get really far down the path, like through phase two trial. The number of times in the book you say, and then it doesn't work in phase three. How can we get so close so many times and then it just doesn't work the next time we try it?
It's a very good question. And I mean, I've personally experienced this in treatments that I've tried for these diseases. Fortunately, I've also been successful in some of them. And in reviewing and putting in all the stories, I myself was struck by how we got so close and then it didn't work. And the reason that is because when you do a bigger trial in people, it involves so many different people and there are biologic variables we don't know. So the way we can be better. Now, you mentioned phase one, phase two, and phase three. Phase one is dosing. Let's say I have a new drug for Alzheimer's. We're trying. We're actually about ready to start a nasal vaccine for Alzheimer's here at the Brigham. The first is dosing, find the right dose. The second is treat people and show that it works. And the third, which is phase three, is treat a lot of people and get approval. And you're right. There have been many trials that in phase two seem to work, and famous doctors said, oh, my God, we had it. And then they do phase three and it doesn't work. One of the ways is maybe to do more than one phase two trial. Test it out a few times before you get to the phase three, before you do the final shot.
And
might be a way.
Yeah. What's the time frame for the average person who's not engaged? You know, so phase one, you start with the dosing all the way to the end of a phase three. 5 years, 10 years?
I mean, it takes time. When I see my patients, they say, you know, when will there be a cure? And of course, an unfortunate person who has the disease and they don't want to hear it takes, you know, so much longer. But I also mentioned in my book that two women can't give birth to a baby in 4.5 months. Biology takes a certain amount of time.
You just can't cut it in half by throwing more people at it, you mean?
Yeah. So the phase one probably takes a couple of years. Phase two probably takes 3 years. And phase three probably takes another 3 or 4 years. So you're talking 10 years.
Yeah. So another piece that was fascinating from the book, I just didn't expect this to show up once, let alone in every chapter, was the gut. So we're having these discussions about these neurologic diseases. They're in the brain. You've got these maps. We're talking about the brain, the crime scene. And now all of a sudden we're in the gut. Every time. That was fascinating. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, what you say is right. When you talk about the gut, we talk about something that's called the microbiome. In our gut, believe it or not, we have like 10 trillion bacteria. And these bacteria evolved with us. And literally in the last 5 or 10 years, we've learned that there's a big genetic factor in our gut with all these bacteria that affect the body and actually relate to every disease, relate to MS, relate to Alzheimer's, relate to Parkinson's, all these diseases. And there's a gut-brain connection. Think about it. If you're nervous, you feel it in your gut. You know, there's a connection there. Here's a fascinating tidbit that people will get a kick out of. If you have a dog and the dog lives in your house, or you have a dog and the dog goes outside, if you have a dog that lives in your house, your children will have more chance to get asthma or allergy. If the dog goes outside, they'll have less chance. Why? Because the dog is bringing in all these bacteria, which could be good. Another interesting thing is that babies who are born by cesarean section often have illness with allergy, et cetera, when they get older, because they weren't colonized in a natural way by all the bacteria in the vaginal canal. So the gut is very important, very complex, but I can tell you it relates not only to the diseases in our book, but it relates to cancer, relates to every other disease. And we're now trying to manipulate the gut by affecting the bacteria to treat disease.
So every listener out there right now is going, so what am I supposed to do about my gut? Am I supposed to eat differently? Am I supposed to take probiotics? He's telling me it's the gut. It's, you know, I don't want to get Alzheimer's. We don't know, right? You're not at that point, correct?
We don't know. One day we'll have something specific for the gut, but I think that, you know, this is common knowledge. If you eat a healthy diet and it helps your gut, that means not a lot of processed foods, not a lot of meat, that type of thing. The Mediterranean diet is probably the best diet to have. And that can make a difference. Everybody asks, how can I prevent Alzheimer's? You know, I lost my mother to Alzheimer's. So eating like a Mediterranean diet, exercise is really important. So as you get older, or even when you're not older, exercising really helps the brain. We have some experiments where we take, and then the other thing, before I tell these experiments, doing intellectual activity helps. Crossword puzzles and keeping yourself intellectually active can also help your brain. We have some experiments where we take mice and we put them in a cage, and then we take other mice and put them in a cage with all these toys. And the mice that play with the toys, their brains are a little healthier. So that's something everyone should do. Getting back to the gut, watch your diet, don't get overweight, not too much processed foods or red meat. If you want to choose a diet, do a Mediterranean type diet.
All right. I think we're going to stop there. There's so much. It's a fascinating book. The book is called The Brain Under Siege by Dr. Howard Weiner. Dr. Weiner is the Robert L. Kroc Professor of Neurology at the Harvard Medical School, director and founder of the Brigham MS Center, and co-director of the Ann Romney Center for Neurologic Diseases at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Weiner, there's a lot there. Thank you so much for sharing some of it with us today on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. Why don't you come back and do it again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.